Hello, welcome back to House of Comments. I'm Charlotte Henry and my lovely co-host is Emma Burnell. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Charlotte. Hello, listeners.
Hello, right. We've got a lot to dig into and we're going to be quick fire because, you know, the cricket's on. But there's been three by-elections.
The cricket, honestly. When is the cricket not on?
Well, we'll get into that. We're not going to get distracted by the Ashes because there's too much to discuss for that. But there's also a hell of a lot to discuss on the back of three by-elections. So Labour wins Selby and Anstey. Massive, massive, massive swing to Labour, almost record-breaking swing to elect a blooming child, which we will discuss in a minute because it's an absolute disgrace. The Lib Dems, another massive swing from the Conservatives to take Somerton and Frome. But here in London, in Uxbridge and South Ruislip, the Conservatives hold on by 495 votes after a recount. So it's 1-1-1 to the three UK parties, obviously. So there's a lot to unpack there. We'll start where you want to start, Emma, which is an enormous win in Selby and Anstey, because that is what was a historically safe Conservative seat. It's an enormous swing and is nothing but a massive Labour victory.
I don't think there's any controversy about calling that a really, really good win for Labour. It's not a red wall seat. It's a classic safe Conservative northern seat. You know, that part of North Yorkshire has always been, it's really near Richmond, which is one of the safest Tory seats in the country. So there really has been quite an extraordinary swing there. And I think what we've seen in both Selby and Anstey and Somerton and Frome is that the voters are not stupid. And this is my endless argument against a formal progressive alliance.
Quite right.
Whether or not...
I mean, you and I don't even like each other. And we support the two quote-unquote progressive parties.
Well, exactly. We can't stand each other. No. We're not going to work together. But I mean, more significantly, there's a reason you're a Lib Dem. There's a reason I'm Labour. And they are different. And I do not consider certain parts of the Lib Dems... programme particularly progressive, and you do not consider certain parts of the Labour programme to be particularly liberal, and the voters are the ones who get to make that choice.
Right. Yeah.
And they have demonstrated time and time again that being patronised is not the way to do that, but letting them go, who's the one who's going to take out the Tory here, right, vote for them, is the way to go. And that is clearly what's happened. You know, you don't get a swing of 24 points directly from Labour to Tory. You get it via voters making that choice and doing so in such a way that they think, what is the most efficient way I can use my vote?
Yep. And I agree entirely with that, because I think a progressive alliance is a quite patronising and very online thing that people have constructed where it doesn't apply to the real world. Like, what's your favourite phrase? Doesn't survive contact with voters.
Yeah.
And I don't think it does in most cases. One, because people can work it out for themselves if that's what they want to do. And two, because, as you say, they're both very different parties. And actually, okay, there's the famous examples in 97 with, you know, Ashdown and Blair being very close. And there was some talk then, but we're a long way from that now.
If Boris Johnson had run again in Uxbridge, you could see a situation in which you might have some sort of Martin Bell type candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone steps aside. But that's like...
For those with less, with shorter political memories, and you remind everyone who Martin Bell was.
Martin Bell ran in Tatton against Neil Hamilton, who had been found to be taking bungs to ask parliamentary questions and receiving the money in brown envelopes, very famously.
Martin Bell is of the famous whitey
Martin
beige
Bell
suit,
wore,
yes?
Wore a white suit. He was the man known as the man in the white suit. He was a war correspondent for the BBC for many, many years, reporting back from war zones in his white suit, and became an anti-corruption campaigner, partly through what he'd seen, I think, in some of those regimes. He only ran for one election there in Tatton. I think he did run another election, which I think was a slight error of judgment, but we'll leave that to one side for the moment. And then the Tories came back in Tatton, and it was George Osborne's seat for quite some time.
Yeah.
So it's the kind of thing I think that can have a very specific utilization in very specific, very limited circumstances. But not the kind of thing that you want to do across the board.
Yeah, and also, I think just on a pure ethical democratic perspective, we activists and or parties don't get to tell other voters who to vote for or else. Like, that's just not how the world works. So let's get back to last night, because we're recording this Friday morning. Let's just underline what a whopping great big win this is in Selby and Anstey. So they overturned a Conservative majority of 20,137. That is the biggest overturned by Labour since 1945.
Yeah.
So that is an absolute schlacking. Labour did overturn it. That was, I think they won mid-staffs, which the seat will definitely be worrying about in a bit, in March 1990, according to Independent. That was a 40,654 majority they managed to overtake back then. So this is serious. And I think, so. And then over in Somerton and Frome, the Lib Dem, now MP Sarah Dyke, has earned 21,187 votes. The Conservative Faye Purbrick picked up just over 10,179. Again, massive, massive swing, massive gap and victory now. So what obviously should be, and I'm sure it is scaring the Conservatives the most, is, yes, all these things are exaggerated in a by-election. Yes, you know, the Lib Dems in particular can go ploughing into a seat in a by-election. Like, they obviously didn't compete at all in the other two seats. They just went hell for leather in Somerton and Frome, which you can't do so efficiently in a national election. Yeah. But this is the pincer movement that the Conservatives were always scared about. Labour in some parts of the country, Lib Dems in other bits of their, you know, the Labour heartlands that the Conservatives also have a say in. And suddenly that's a real problem for the Conservatives.
Yeah, they're being pinched in two different directions. Yeah. With very little concept of how to turn that around. All of the interviews this morning have gone either very hard on their holding on to Uxbridge,
which we will come to, because I do think that's interesting. We'll come to that.
But also just pivoting back to the five promises, which they're unlikely to keep. They don't really mean much to people. To everyday lives. Like, they're all very amorphous. They're not like, you will feel richer by the end of this year, you will feel more secure by the end of this year, if you need a mortgage, you'll be able to get one by the end of this year, if you are struggling to pay rent, you will not be struggling to pay rent by the end of this year. Yeah. Or even, we will start to build 100,000 new homes by the end of this year. Mm-hmm. None of this is happening. It's all like, we'll halve inflation, so things will go up, but they'll go up slightly.
Well, that is, yeah, I mean, that's how, we've always had some level of inflation. You need some level of inflation, but yes, you're right.
We will reduce national debt. Well, literally nobody thinks you're going to do that. Literally nobody.
Yeah, there is. Okay, carry on. There is a story today that the government borrowed less than due inspected.
But it's still record levels of debt borrowing. Sure. Like, nobody, it's just not, like, I don't think it's actually.
And also, it doesn't mean anything to anyone anyway.
No, and what is government debt to me? It's not the same as me not being able to pay my gas bill.
Sure.
We will reduce waiting lists. Well, no, you won't. That ain't happening. Haven't seen them stopping. The day after their vicious legislation passed, I think something like nearly 600 people arrived on boats.
So it's
like a bunch of empty promises, and they're not even good promises.
Yeah, and just drilling into the by-elections, the swing in Somerton was 29%. Mm. That's huge. Again, you're
24%.
So exactly. Both of them were absolutely enormous. Absolutely right.
And the Labour candidate in Somerton and Frome lost.
Is a child.
No, that's the one in Selby and
Yes, Ash. Selby is a child, Emma.
No, he's 25.
Child.
They made Thatcher was the first time she ran for Parliament. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. Very good stat for the morning. Thank you.
Oh. Yeah, look, do I want everyone in Parliament to be 25? No. Do I think it's okay to have some people in Parliament who are 25? Yes. Do I think the Tories, having put someone who is
31
in
Ross
the
is 31
law, a job for life, have a leg to stand on this one? No, I do not.
I mean, having the combination of the two, I'm 35, about to be 36, and like having seen Ross Kemp, who I've had a drink with a couple of times, perfectly pleasant company, he's aged 31 in his ermine getting admitted to the House of Lords, and then see a 25-year-old MP, I'm like checking into a care home, honestly.
I'm 48. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, you and I can have a lovely time together in the care home. So yeah, we've dealt these two wins, and I think we're right to emphasise the pincer movement, because that, if I was in CCHQ at any level, would be the thing that is terrifying me. But we do have to unpick the one Conservative victory of the night, which was in Boris Johnson's old seat of Uxbridge and South Ruislip, because let's be honest, whatever the sort of expectation management, whatever Angela Rayner is saying on TV this morning, deep down, Labour thought they were going to nick this.
Yes.
And it's a bit of a miss.
It is a bit of a miss. And there are kind of two things behind it, I think. Maybe two and a half. So I was talking to someone from a Conservative, I think, voter. He didn't tell me that outright, but sure. Where he was talking made me think he was a Conservative voter from the constituency yesterday. And he
just if you don't mind me asking, did you do some campaigning in one of these seats?
No, this was someone I met.
Okay. I was just interested what the sort of doorstep kind of vibe was. That was
I didn't do any campaigning, which is good because I actually like to eat food and drink water.
Yes, I saw you do have to look after your activists.
And he said that there was actually quite a lot of residual fondness for Boris. Boris is within the Tory voters. And he said that if they lose it, it would be because people were not coming out because they were angry at Boris's treatment.
How interesting.
Which I thought was very interesting. So that's my half a point. You, Les, was obviously a big...
Yeah, I want to jump into that in a minute.
And the other thing is that there is a narrative about the donut, the London donut, which is how Boris won London last year. He concentrated on the outer boroughs.
And how he always became mayor.
Yeah. That's what I meant. That's how he became mayor. There is a strong narrative about lots of more progressive, socially liberal, Labour-leaning voters being forced out of zones 1 and 2 and into zones 3, 4, 5 and 6. And that is true.
For people that don't live in London, i.e. people who were living in more central parts of London being pushed further and further out.
Into the suburbs, which Uxbridge absolutely is. I think it's zone 6. And I think that is true, but it's not the whole truth, because there are other people who have also left London for the suburbs, particularly during the pandemic, who are more, you know, find themselves, you know, Tory voters who used to, you know, London used to be a Tory city. Everyone forgets this, but they found themselves less and less inclined to London life, London vibe, whatever, who have also moved out. So while overall, I think there is more and more of that, and we'll see that in some of the home counties. We'll see that in some of the Surrey seats, Hertfordshire, Essex, Kent, and some of the outer London seats. I think London have probably got a very good shout of getting Chingford, Woodford Green, for example. I think that there has been too much emphasis on that demographic shift without thinking that, you know, there are other people moving out of central London as well.
Yep. For me, though, there's two things. So first of all, I thought Labour, I think we both said Labour were going to win this seat.
Yeah. I said the one that I thought was more worrying for Labour was Selby and Anstey. Yeah. So I was completely wrong.
Yeah, because we were basically looking at the majorities, weren't we? The whopping great white big one in Selby and Anstey, and the much tighter one of just over 7,000. In Uxbridge. But so I thought it was a small, most attackable majority. It You could really put, I thought there would be a lot of resentment towards Boris Johnson and what had happened in that seat, which from your quite interesting anecdote seems not to be the case.
Well, I mean, I it's just one anecdote.
Sure.
It's not data, but I think it's, again, it's just a more complex picture than we think.
Yes. And obviously the big, big thing that came up in this and will obviously be a feature of the mayoral election, however hopeless the Conservative candidate is ULEZ, which you explained the other week. It's the kind of environmental charge on much older, much dirtier, much more polluting vehicles. It's £12.50 a day to drive into London with that. So basically, if you live in one of these seats and you have one of these cars, as soon as you leave your drive, you would be charged for it, basically, which is the issue in these places. Now, this was obviously a really hot button issue. As I understand it, that's basically all the Conservatives campaigned on in that seat.
Yeah, and clearly done them very well. I mean, as someone who thinks the ULEZ is a good idea, possibly being poorly implemented, certainly I think being poorly communicated, mm-hmm. I think that you can't deny that that's been...
It's been a huge...
You lose an election by less than 500 votes and that election has been run essentially as a referendum on one issue. You can't deny that that's...
And interestingly, Lawrence Fox and Reform, who basically only ran on that issue as well, because he has no political nous and didn't realise that that might actually give Labour the seat, got 700 votes. So actually, he very much could have cost the Conservatives the seat. But anyway, I've been thinking about ULEZ quite a lot as this has escalated. Andrew Rayner made a very good point on the TV this morning, and that's not a sentence I usually say. But she pointed out, and quite rightly, what's that?
Because you're classist and you can't bear a working class woman doing good.
Yeah, yeah, you've noticed that, yeah. That's definitely right. It's not that I just disagree with everything she says. But she made a very good point, which was that ULEZ is probably coming to other towns and cities in the UK because it's very easy to make this seem like a London-centric, London-only issue. And she is absolutely right to point out that that's not the case. Because it will almost certainly come into other towns and cities in the UK. And, you know, she was talking about, you know, might have to change the amount people pay for scrappage, i.e. how much people get paid to get rid of their old car and get a newer one, those kind of things. And I'm sure that's right. And I think they'll have discussions within the Labour Party about that after this result. But I think there's another element to it as well. I think there is quite a big, and I've seen campaigners around me who are opposing you. I'm in an area that is getting it. And there's been lots of campaigners against it around where I live. And I think this is as much about freedom as it is about the environment. I think people have...
Oh, I hate that freedom word because people just misuse it.
Well, that's because you're a...
To choke you to death.
No, no, that's just because you're a terrible oppressive socialist. But I think there is an element within these campaigners, whether it's right or wrong, that cars equal independence and freedom, and that this is another thing. And I say that as someone who...
A polluting vehicle is not the same as no car at all. My
quite
car
so.
Is not... It's ULEZ compliant. I've had it for 10 years.
About 90%.
It's not overcompensating for anything, so it doesn't have an enormous polluting engine.
And about 90% of vehicles are compliant.
Yeah.
And I say that I'm saying all this as someone who basically is in favour of ULEZ. I don't drive, but I'm basically in favour of it because I don't think we should be sitting around in 2020 behind vehicles chucking out black smoke, which you do still see occasionally. So I'm basically compliant, you know, in favour of it. But I think campaigners are making this point about freedom, whether you like it or not. I think
I'm sure they are. They're just dickheads and disingenuous.
No, I think particularly in the wake of kind of COVID lockdowns and all that stuff, I think that part of the discussion does at least need to be taken into, you know, consideration. Again, I'm not saying I agree with that argument or not. I'm not even arguing against ULEZ because I think I basically agree with it. I'm just saying I think there's more to it than saying these are people that don't care about the environment or it's just about money. I think there is a slightly wider ideological point.
I think there is an ideological point, but it's a disingenuous one.
I'm not sure. No, I don't think it is.
Taking away your freedom, they're asking you to drive a different vehicle. As it really is that simple. It's yes. not you can never drive a vehicle again. No. That would be oppressive and taking away your freedom. It's saying if you're going to drive a vehicle, drive one that's not going to kill a bunch of people.
Yeah, and ruin our air and make children
live. As someone who suffered from childhood asthma, thank goodness I don't have it as an adult, but you have no idea how terrifying it is to have your own lungs not work.
Oh, I'm not arguing with any of it, and I keep reiterating, I'm not even arguing against you, Les, but I think if you want to bring people with you, and I think we should bring people with us on this, because, again, I think it's important that we clean up the air in London, I think you have to at least take some of that into consideration. I think it is
you
an important part of
their idiotic argument, definitely.
Well, I think dismissing it as idiotic won't work.
And counter it, but nobody is taking away anybody's freedom. That is just basic. And if we go, oh, you've probably got a little bit of the height now, I'm such a wet woolly liberal, then you don't counter the argument. You don't address it properly for the disingenuous lie that it is.
I don't think it is disingenuous. I think people sincerely feel that, and you can have a...
People sincerely feel something that is a disingenuous lie.
But it's not.
It is a disingenuous... Nobody's taking away your freedom, Charlotte.
No.
It's a lie.
No one's taking away your freedom,
but... If everyone's doing it and people are saying they're doing it, it is a lie.
People who are campaigning against you, Les, that some element of that campaign feels they're being, again, told what to do. I think that's the basic premise of it.
But that's different from they're taking away my freedom.
Well, but that's how these arguments always get centered. Again, I don't particularly buy it. I think... Yes, you might have to alter some of the scrappage payments and stuff to help people along the way.
There are definitely ways that you could adjust the ULEZ scheme, particularly during a cost of living crisis, to make sure that people who are, for example, a white van man having a hard time with the cost of living, although, frankly, you plumbers are some of the richest people in bloody London at the moment.
Yeah, I'm retraining.
But you could make the pinch points different. You can communicate it better, but that is not the same as accepting that anyone saying that your freedom is being taken away has a realistic argument.
No, but you do also have to, and we don't need to have a whole debate about yours, but this is a key part of what happened in this seat.
Their communication on you, Les, was better than ours, not least because the Labour candidates suddenly went, oh, I don't really know about you, Les, halfway through.
Sure.
Instead of either addressing the arguments head on, and it all just felt a bit wet.
Yeah. And I think there is a general mood. Let me put it this way before we end. We don't need to go back and forth on it. But I think there is a general mood in some parts of society that people are, and this is not just my own natural libertarian tendencies coming out, where I think people are a little bit fed up of being told what to do by government. I think it's a bit of a fallout from COVID. And I think ULEZ is one of those kind of pinch points, and that campaigners against it are playing on. Let me put it that way.
I think that's true. I think it's a minority. I think it's a very noisy minority.
Of course it is, yeah.
But I think that the answer to it isn't to go, oh, yeah, you kind of got a point. It's actually to address it head on.
Oh, yeah, have a proper discussion, absolutely. Let's talk about what this means for the Labour Party, because it was a mess. And it's, I think, a tension point now. It's going to be between the Labour national leadership, i.e. Sir Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves, Angela Rayner, and in this case, Ed Miliband, and Sadiq Khan. Sadiq Khan is going to win very, very, very comfortably a third mayor's London term. He will be the London mayor at the time of the next election, whenever that is. Labour don't want to lose a group of outer London seats because of Sadiq Khan. They don't want to have to be arguing between the most high-profile mayor in the country, whatever Andy Burnham tries, and the leadership. There is going to have to be a discussion about this within Labour and sort it out, so they can all speak with one voice, surely.
Well, see, this is the problem. I'm a big believer in devolution.
Sure.
And one of the outcomes of devolution is that they won't always speak with one voice, because different parts of the country need different things and want different things. And we're all going to have to grow up about that a little bit. But it is...
I mean, I love your optimism.
I mean, yeah. I don't think it's going to happen, but it is one of the complexities of devolution, that essentially, what if you devolve power and decision making, you don't then get to impose power and decision making.
Yes, you're absolutely right, but surely there is going to have to be
some
level of synchronicity,
get a narrative together.
Yes, that's what.
But that doesn't have to mean that Lotto impose their narrative on everybody else, because I don't think that's going to work or happen or be accepted by any of the mayors.
Well, one of the things that happened in the Corbyn years, of course, is that some very senior, strong personalities left Parliament to become mayors. Khan, Andy Burnham, etc., etc., etc. And so these are not kind of people that the Leader of the Opposition's office can steamroller.
Yeah, but Khan was running for mayor before Corbyn was elected.
Sure, but my point is, in that period of time, there are now a group of very high profile, very strong personality Labour mayors that are not going to just do what the central party tells them.
Again, that's part of the understanding, like the grown-up understanding of the world that we're in.
Again, I love your optimism.
Well, I mean, it's not optimism. It's the honest truth is these people are not going to accept a diktat from Lotto. That's not optimistic. That's realistic.
No, but
that's the case that we're going to be in. So you are going to have these tensions. Now, the question is, can they and will they be managed? And that's where there's an optimistic and a pessimistic argument to be had. Because I don't know is the answer.
Well, you and I both know how political media works, and that we know that during an election, people will try and make these wedge differences a big wedge issue and a narrative, won't they?
They will. And in part, that will happen more in London for three reasons. Firstly, there is a fairly vicious anti-Sadiq Khan mood in the Tory party. Can't imagine what it is about him they don't like. And there is also the fact that we are a deeply London-centric media, who make jokes about Andy Burnham being King of the North just because we just absolutely dismiss the idea that anyone should have any power outside of the M25. And thirdly, that it will be politically expedient to do this. Whether it will make the kind of difference that it made in a by-election, I'm less sure.
Right. I think as we kind of wrap up the show, that's what we have to say about all three of these results. So I would suspect, for example, that the Lib Dems would have had to do something catastrophic to not keep Summer Timmerman Froome in an upcoming general election. They should now bed in and win that in a general election. I think that's very important. I think Labour holding on to Selby and Anstey in a general election is now possible, but difficult. Because sometimes we all know that sometimes in a by-election, people like to give the governing party, particularly if they're holding the seat, a kicking, and then might revert to the mean in a general election. I think the nature of the upcoming general election might not mean that's happened, but it's plausible. Yeah. And I think in Uxbridge and a lot of the outer London seats, there is going to be some really nasty campaigning and a bit of a mess. And I couldn't tell you how that's going to play out.
I think that the national swing was bigger extrapolated from these three by-elections, even taking Uxbridge into account, than the national poll swing.
Sure.
That won't be the case in a general election necessarily. It will probably be smaller, but big enough. Again, talking to some Conservatives yesterday, and they just said they've just given up. They're out of steam. They're out of energy.
Do you not think holding on to Uxbridge kind of gives
Conservatives 500 votes? No.
Well, given that it was expected to be lost.
Yeah, I think that I think if they think, oh, yay, we don't have to do anything now.
No, great. I don't think anyone's serious since that.
You do it that way. But they haven't got anything in the tank, Charlotte. This is the problem. It's literally just revert back to the five promises, and maybe tease some inheritance tax cuts, which is the most bullshit thing that I've ever heard. And I just, I don't know what they could do. Like, what can they do? What are the things that change the narrative so dramatically?
Well, I think we'll come back to that after the summer, actually, because I don't think, looking at these three results, my mind about what will happen in an upcoming general election, her talk, there was a story last night that Rishi Sunak might push it back to November 2024, just try and hold it for as long as possible, just give them any chance at all of people feeling better economically and whatever. Okay, fair enough. So we're talking kind of a year and a half at most for a general election. Ish, slightly less. And I said to you, basically when we started this show, didn't I, there was a route to victory for the Conservatives, but it was very, very narrow.
Yeah, and it's got narrow.
And as you and I have done this show week by week, it's got narrower and narrower, and we've discussed lots of the reasons why. And looking at those three results from last night, nothing has changed my view on that, that it's now so narrow as to be almost impossible. But one of the other, of course, big factor that has changed since you and I have been doing this show is Scotland, in which there will be undoubtedly more Labour victories than in 2019.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm taking away from looking at these three results, that on certain issues in certain areas, the Conservatives might be able to hold on. But there is a huge pincer movement that is probably going to cost them the whole, the being in government. That's my takeaway.
Yeah, I think people, I mean, I've been saying this for some time, the weather's changed. And when the weather changes, it's very, very hard to do anything about it. And people are fed up of the Tories. They're not massively over-enthused by either the Lib Dems or Labour, but they're so sick to the back teeth of these Tories and they just want rid.
I'm glad you made that point, because yes, I don't think there's a huge, there's not kind of cool Britannia mania about like there was for
no
Tony
cool
Blair.
Britannia mania. There's no Davy mania.
There's no, I agree with Nick, kind of that vibe.
None of that. It's just efficient loathing of the Tories.
Just, even if it's not a strong loathing, it's just a general sense of being fed up and wanting something to change, as I'm reading it.
I think it's a bit of both. I think there is, if you're getting 24% swings, 29% swings, that's not fed up, that's loathing.
That's a, I mean, yeah, I think that's what we should really end on, is that the two, yes, Labour missed out and will be kicking themselves that they didn't get the full sweep in Uxbridge. And they will, and I don't think that we should kind of gloss over that miss, but the kicking that the Conservatives got in the two other seats and the battle they had to do to hold on to just one of them is really the big takeaway. Well, we're going to slightly disappear for the summer, sort of. Don't worry, there will still be plenty of House of Commons, because Emma and I have done, if you don't mind me saying, some fantastic interviews. We've got some brilliant, brilliant people coming up. We've got, actually, do you know what? I'm not going to trailer them. You need to keep checking your feed, because there are people we've got coming up that you definitely, definitely, definitely want to hear from.
But it's our summer book club, isn't it?
There's a bit of a summer book club. There's some people in actual frontline politics. There's some great people coming up from all across the political spectrum, and you definitely are going to want to hear them. So make sure you're following House of Commons wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure you're sharing and telling your friends. We'll put it all out on social media as well. We'll be back we'll be back if anything chaotic happens, so maybe see you in a week. We'll also be back, if not before, in September. So I hope you enjoy those interviews we've done. Where can people keep up with you over the summer and everything else, Emma?
I'm on all of the apps now. I can't just say Twitter. I'm on Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram. Just look for me on there. And then I've also got a newsletter called Hard Thinking on the Soft Left, which you can subscribe to.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Twitter and all the other social media apps, or at Charlotte A. Henry if you can't find me at Charlotte A. Henry. Head over to theaddition.net. And if you don't, I'm going to brag for a moment. You can sign up to my award-winning newsletter.
I won.
I was named best solo.
I know you were nominated, but I didn't know you'd won. That's fantastic. Well done, Charlotte.
Cheers, mate. Yes, I was named best solo newsletter at the inaugural Publisher Newsletter Awards, and I was blooming chuffed about it. If I'm honest, I'm not going to do any fake modesty. I was chuffed. So you can head over to theaddition.net or newsletter.theaddition.net and sign up to my award-winning newsletter. Please do follow at HSC Podcast on Twitter as well, because then you won't miss any of the fantastic interviews we have coming up. And we'll see you all soon.